Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, damas y caballeros, leave it in.
Welcome back to another edition of Leave the Ring Radio. I'm your host, Dave Duenas, with my co-host, Mr. Gable Montoya. Hey, what's up, Gable? How you doing, brother?
I'm good. I can't see myself on the switchboard, which kind of freaked me out. But if you can hear me, then everything's fine.
Yeah, we're both on the switchboard. That's why I called in tap myself.
So weird.
Anyways.
Gotcha. Why are you messing with me?
Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. I know we didn't have a Thanksgiving show. We just figured... You know what, and for me, especially in the holidays, which I really hate, and I think I even tweeted that out, that I hate holidays. I'm not a holiday person. I'm not really a people person, as a lot of people know. I just get really busy, you know, with the kids and the family and stuff. So I didn't have any time, man. I couldn't squeeze in, a couple hours, which Gable wanted to do, like an early Thursday show and then or early Friday show. I was driving out of town, and he was driving out of town. So we apologize, but here's the thing.
One of these things, I mentioned it before, that we've been kind of roving around, and it's on me. You know, I'm doing a rehearsals for a show, and it's a really big show. It's like 45 actors, something like that, like cabaret show, like dancing girls and the whole bit. And so it's a lot of people to, like, coordinate, you know. And so if they call me and they need me, I'm pretty available because I just work as a writer. So they called me in, they needed me for rehearsal, and I need it because with that many actors, like any time the director wants to spend some time with you, you just go, because a lot of it is spending time working on your own, and then you go try your stuff out, and he tells you whether or not it works. That's how, you know, theater works. So it's on me that we're kind of moving around, and I really appreciate it. I guess this year, one of the many things I've been thankful for this year is having you, Dave, working right alongside me. You know, even when we haven't been doing episodes, we've been working on the future, which I know you're about to talk about. And I'm loving the partnership. Everybody at Max Boxing is loving it. So there you go. That's what I'm thankful for.
I was going to roll into that because, you know, as we all know, you know, our Gmail account is Leave It in the Ring, and we get a lot of people that they'll either tweet us, or Facebook message us, or a lot of times they'll just send us a direct message on Leave It in the Ring Gmail. And that's mostly where you can reach myself or somebody else, and we can answer whatever. And I had a few letters where we're like, you know, what's going on? You guys are just like now randomly just picking days and time to want to do something. And this was my response to two listeners who I wrote back. And, you know, we've been around for not just the radio. I think the radio, I can't remember the amount of years, but myself, you know, I came from YouTube, and I established myself on YouTube, and after YouTube, I decided to start a website because nobody was doing that. There was another guy named Jose Fire was doing YouTube videos, and I was going to gyms and filming, and then I decided to go on the website, and during the process of the website, I decided, you know what, there's something else lacking. There was only probably maybe two or three other internet radio shows, and not to take nothing away from them, I just felt like they weren't bringing it up to par or the coverage that I thought boxing fans wanted to hear and needed to hear. So I started Leaving the Ring. And then from there, we have kind of rolled on. We did 3 hours. We were even doing it Thursdays and Sundays at one time for the first two, maybe 3 years of Leaving the Ring. And this year has just been a really difficult year in terms of Gable getting married and going back to theater. And myself, where I just received my home inspector license. You know, everybody knows I'm a union plumber, been a plumber for going on 19 years. But I also wanted to try something different, a different pace, and I got my state license, which I had to study for practically 3 months, and was getting no sleep. I was putting in a lot of that, and I'm also investing in another company. And really, and here's the funny thing. A lot of the things that I do investment-wise, it's really – I don't make any money because it filters right back into the boxing. And this year alone, if you know me very well – for 2013, I didn't cover any fights. Like, I literally didn't go to any fights, really. And for 2014, I want to change that. I want to be able to go out there. We started a documentary called The Hurt Business, and we never were able to finish it off. And that's something that was true to my heart that I want to continue to do, just because the fact that we're rolling into the safety fighters, subject, along with story that, you know, the great Brian Fogg. If you haven't followed him, you got to follow Brian Fogg. He's a writer for Leaving the Ring. This guy's phenomenal. He found another very interesting story, which I'm not going to break until we get all of our ducks in a row for this story. It's really huge, and it's something I think a lot of fight fans are going to be very interested about hearing, and it's also going to be very human for you to hear and understand about this particular person's life story. But overall, you know, we're not going anywhere. You know, it just sometimes timing is everything, and sometimes we need to take a break to reevaluate ourselves and to see what direction we're going, you know. And I've talked to a few publicists, and in disappointment, I've had to turn down interviews just because the fact that, you know, there's, I don't know how many, I can't even, put my toes and my fingers together. There's more than that. Put Gabriel's fingers and toes together. Put yours. There's just so many. And I think they're doing a great job in getting fighters interviews and doing whatnot. We just want to look for a different direction. And that's basically what Leaving the Ring has always kind of been about, is to try to find the story that people really want to hear and really dig deep into something that we truly love and we feel that is lacked in coverage. That being said, I want to read a passage that I ran across, because if anybody knows me, I love to read historian books of boxers from back in the history, from the 1800s, from the Queensberry Rules. I'm one of those guys that are just very fascinated with that era. And there's a passage that's not really part of that era, but it was more in the mix going towards, I believe, in the 70s and 80s. I could be wrong, but my son, my boy just walked in the house. Close the door, please. Sorry about that. Anyways, and it says, a boxer subtly constructed, intelligently directed, and soundly motivated is bound to go a long way. And that was by A.J. Liebing from Sweet Science. And that was, it was a book called Sweet Science.
Oh, yeah. That's my favorite boxer book.
And what I liked about that passage is everything that's put in wording of how to construct the perfect fighter is right there. Those are the fundamentals. Those are the underlines of how to build a fighter. The thing, though, is that constructed soundly, solidly, or intelligently, or motivated, one of those key words is going to lack in a fighter. And I had a chance to listen to, and you know what, if you don't follow Gabriel's tweets and you don't follow a lot of his work, Gabriel sometimes will go off on the sidelines and do something a little bit different. And what I'm talking about, he did an interview, I believe this past weekend, on a show called The Journey. And one of the topics and monologues of the show was fighters of today compared to fighters of yesterday. The spirit of fighters. The last of the hard men to the men of the cheating drugs. And when he talked about that, it really just stuck out there where I couldn't really get it out of my mind. Because if you make the comparisons of how fighters are constructed from back in the from the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and even in the early 90s, from when it went down to the millennium, it really changed. Everything just basically went to a different direction. But there were signs of those directions happening in the beginning of the 90s, okay? And Gabriel will kind of point out some of that because he knows where I'm going to go with this in a minute. And when I listened to that short part of topic and discussion that Gabriel was talking with the Journey host, which I can't remember their names. I apologize for the guys that and Gabriel, if you could retweet that interview out there so people can later, you know, favor it so they can listen to that interview a bit later after Leaving the Ring show, that'd be great. But so I'm remembering the topic, right, and I decided to go through, because I have like over 1,000 DVDs and VHS filled with fights. And occasionally, man, I'll go through them and decide to sit there and have a cup of coffee or a nice cold beer, whatever poison I decide to just consume into my body. I'll sit there and I'll thumb through fights. And I started going through Julio Cesar Chavez Sr. started watching when he fought Roger Mayweather the first time, the second time, and then so forth and so forth. And really started watching from the beginning of his career and stayed with it where my eyes were literally burning because I didn't want to go to bed because I wanted to try to complete his career in the compilations of DVDs that I had of Julio Cesar Chavez. And it went all the way down to when he fought like Frankie Randall. But what I noticed about Julio was the beginning he knew how to slip punches, bob and weave. He knew how to throw over the top of a straight jab. He knew how to cut the ring off. He knew how to cut the distance so he can get a body shot and then always finish it with a left hook. He knew how to throw combinations and always finish it with a left hook. And those little sound things that he did, as a youngster back in the 80s and going on to the 90s and then rolling into the millennium, Julio was the epitome of what a Mexican fighter was supposed to look like and be. But towards the end of the career, going towards Frankie Randall, a lot of it diminished. A lot of it just started disappearing, the bobbing, the weaving, the slipping, the throwing over a jab, cutting off the ring. He started to take a lot of shots. He started to show that he had a great chin, but he also started to show that he would follow you and stalk you rather than cut the ring and be a perfect assassin by just tagging that body. Little by little, it just started deteriorating, and the strips of who he was started becoming an old man. And that old image of Julio really stuck with the later Y generation. And that's what I'm going to roll in about what a lot of young Mexican fighters like to either tweet or say about themselves. It's like, I want to be the next Julio Cesar Chavez. And they do have that motivation to be him. Brandon Rios is a perfect example. He went out there. He showed he could take a massive beating. He showed he could take a massive hit. He showed that he'll go through anything. He'll go through the fire to try to land one big shot. But he forgot the fundamentals. He forgot the being intelligently directed, being solidly constructed, as Julio Cesar Chavez was at one time as a young warrior. Because those are the key things. Those two things right there, being extremely motivated, you've got to have that. But without the other two, the mixture is just plain water. There's no punch to it. There's nothing behind it. The substance is just dull. And watching Brandon Rios, who had tremendous motivation, and people applauded him, and I applaud him as well. He took his beating like a man. But I sat there and I watched everything wrong that he could have done right. But the problem was, it wasn't just the overall what he was doing. It was the overall what the team was doing. For an example is, in the early rounds when Manny Pacquiao would tie him up, Brandon did a very smart thing, which Andre Ward does, is if he has a free hand, he uses it. But here's the thing, is that Brandon never decided to walk Manny Pacquiao back to those ropes. Never decided to try to trap him at those ropes when he had the opportunity when Manny decided to tie him up. Those are some small things that Julio Cesar Chavez used to do himself. You try to tie him up, he would have one arm open, but at the same time, he would move you in the direction where he would trap you so that he can dictate whether you're going to go left or right. He could dictate how long he could keep you in that corner. He could dictate the damage that he could do so that he could soundly take a step back, evaluate the damage that he has performed so that he could continue breaking you down until he had his way with you. The other thing is Brandon never finished with a left hook. Brandon never decided to leave with a straight right. And when he did, he landed. Nothing came behind that. And those are things that if you're in the generation Y and you're in this generation now, if you're an amateur kid or you're a kid right now that's in the pro and you've got maybe four or six fights and you're Mexican, black, white, it doesn't matter what color creed you are. Those are the things that you need to look at. And those are the things you got to realize don't win fights. Yes, you got there. But there's that saying, you get to the top, then what do? Gabriel?
Oh, I think, you know, you're kind of just breaking down what Brandon didn't do in those fights, but I don't think that if you looked at his career, not to denigrate it, but I mean, Justin Fortune said it best when I talked to him heading into that fight. I said, is this going to be like Margarito? And he said, no, Margarito is a better fighter than Brandon Rios. He actually defended his belt like multiple times, like 8 times over a period. He did his job with Top Rank, and then he made weight. He held down a belt at a weight until it was time for a bigger name dude to fight him, which was Floyd, which never happened. But that's what that fight was. Promotionally, you know, thinking long term, that's what that fight was supposed to be. It was, like, you know, Floyd's coronation at 47, he'd pick up the belt and then defend against some good-ass names, and we get some good-ass fights, maybe Cotto at some point. But then, you know, he went his own way. But that's what Rios was basically supposed to be. But he wasn't able to do that. He missed weight, then they missed weight again. So I think it was a really – it said a lot about the camp. I mean, I'm not trashing anybody here, but I found it interesting that they went at it again, trying to lose that weight and keep a belt rather than move up. I wonder, you know, if Rios – it abbreviated this process. I mean, I think a lot of things did. You know, Top Rank doesn't exactly have a ton of guys to throw at Pacquiao, and certainly not a ton of great fights for him that are winnable to extend his career. Like, Bradley's not a good matchup, and it still isn't, no matter what we saw in the Rios fight. Rios, I thought, was a limited guy. I thought at least he would go for a little more. But I thought the thing that he was really lacking, besides his overall energy to get done what he needed done, with smaller steps. I think he spent a lot of time just walking through sand, it seemed like, towards Pacquiao, just kind of stalking without really doing anything. You know, you've got to be – remember, Frankie Duarte is a trainer over at Fortune Gym, old fighter, and he always talks about the bounce. You know, he's like slides, and he's like moving his shoulders, and it has nothing to do with – a lot of guys do a lot of weird extraneous movement anymore. It's like an amateur thing where they dance along the edge of the perimeter and they fully face the opponent. You don't really see a lot of old-time fighters doing that. Like, nowadays, either guys are throwing flashy combos and getting out of the way that don't really do much damage, or they're doing that. They're, like, stepping away, and there's not, like, gray area to their game. There's not a lot of mid-range guys that really like to mix it up. Like, I was breaking down, like, Glenn Tapia Kirkland on tape, and one, I think Kirkland, when he's in great shape, his upper body movement is his defense, is a part of it. He does parry with his arms, but he's not very fast. He's not super quick. So he's got to be in perpetual motion. He needs to be in great shape to do that. So we're rewatching him with Angulo and with Molina. The difference was the amount of energy that he could put out. With Tapia, though, I wonder if he's cutting a lot in order to get to where he's at. It's interesting that the fight is above 154. Because he's one of those guys that, to me, there isn't a lot of gray area to his game. When he's all the way in, he's not the most active, most comfortable inside fighter. His defense is kind of leaky when he's moving along on the outside. And I wonder if it's this generation of fighters or if it's this generation of trainers that are kind of missing the finer points of the game. You know, looking back at, like you talk about Customato, or you talk about the left hook, and that's one of Customato's tenets for a boxer, you know, always come back with the hook that leaves you in position to throw every other punch, and you know, the other one was handle your own money, and get up at you know, if you get knocked down, stay down until 8, don't be a hero, just clear your head, get up at 8 and get back fighting. But the final one was that, always come back with a hook, it Brandon didn't do a lot of things. I don't think he set himself up in a position to get anything done, you know.
Well, you know, here's
kind of
the thing,
a strange
too.
Performance. There was an adjustment in the third, wouldn't you say, when they were working in the clinches. And Brandon was actually working, and Manny was kind of looking at the ref like, are you gonna fight this fight for me? You know, when I hold him, are you going to break his fast? Once he realized that wasn't going to happen, Pacquiao just started spinning and pivoting all night long and had Brandon totally confused and lost in space.
Well,
it was
not,
a masterful
not
performance.
That. You know, he was totally confused, because here's one thing that a lot of fighters that I've noticed of the generation that are coming out now, they do. If you look at that back foot, I call it the dead foot. That dead foot is just basically there. You know, the front foot does all the work. The back foot just drags like a tail. And when
it's
a guy
like
gives you angles.
A lot of guys, you know. It's all sideways, these days. You notice that? Like, Justin Fortune.
Even Guerrero does
one of the biggest.
Guerrero does this.
Oh,
thing.
Yeah. A lot of guys do it, and you look at the Cubans. Rigondeaux's different because he's got his own that weird side-to-side thing. But mostly, look at the back feet, and sometimes he plants back on it, but a lot of times facing the back foot and the front foot towards the opponent, which is actually, like, Justin, he's a Muay Thai guy as well as a boxer. It's a Muay Thai footwork thing, and Jeet Kune Do does it too. But it makes it so that, you get more explosion off the back foot.
Absolutely.
And when you turn the torque, I think the idea to have the back foot pointed out like that is so that when you turn that back and your hips and everything come forward for your rear punch, that you're getting torque and that you end up kind of pointing towards your opponent.
The reason, too, to have that back foot up is that when you pivot, you're not picking the back foot to turn. You're sliding it. So it makes it a lot quicker. It also helps you, to really close up the gap of inches that you need with the back foot. The back foot is very, very crucial and much needed to be learned in order to do some of the tricks that you'll see the late fighters used to do. Let's talk about power with the back foot. Tito Trinidad is a perfect example. Watch his back foot and how he would throw it straight right.
Mm-hmm.
He made sure every leverage was to his advantage. Mike Tyson did the same thing.
And the very
compact, now you watch
too. Tito had his, remember the way he would have his gloves like right by his face. They were right there at his chin. They weren't totally high up protecting the temple, but they were right there at shoulder, so he could just let it go. You're right, and we're talking young Tito, not Tito when he moved back down to 47 to wait around for the Oscar fight, but the 21-year-old that was just all over Maurice Blocker like a cheap suit, that Tito, he had the bounce. He had the same kind of energy.
Yep, he sure did. Even Oscar De La Hoya had the bounce. He had that really famous bounce when he found something. He bounced around and he would dart in and out. There's a lot of things that you really don't see. Hopefully what happens is with this era of the cheating drugs, that we meet the cycle again, because in that topic you guys were talking about, the last of the hard men from the 1920s of the work ethic of these guys were doing, these guys came from veteran fathers that just got back from Vietnam or World War I or World War II. Their parents were working in warehouses. It was a time in an era of depression, and it really gave birth to these guys that had a working background that they implied into the gym, where now a lot of fighters are born into the Y generation. They're more born into this social media and fast, computer era, where they all want to see results fast. Nobody wants to work for it. So it leads down to PEDs and HGH. I hope, though, because of, of the war we've been in, and Afghanistan and whatnot, and that, with fathers away, and this is sad because we are in a depression again in our country, in our society, that there's a lot of families that are losing homes. There's a lot of families that are not doing a daily job. There's a lot of families working for minimum wage that are barely making it. And the only place that could be a babysitter, because they probably don't have cable or anything, is a gym. But at the same time, how many of those gyms, boxing gyms, are really being filled because of the MMA gyms that pop like every corner? So I'm hoping the cycle of fighters are going to go back to tradition, which is forget the cheating drugs and go more into the traditional way of building a fighter. And those fundamentals that I mentioned a little while ago are really the sound way of building a fighter.
Oh, I've been looking over Custom Auto stuff. We watched Undisputed, the play, which – I prefer Tyson, the documentary, I got to say. The filming plays is always, it's just kind of like a losing proposition. You can never quite, if it was great live and in person, there's something about live performance that, just like a fight, every one of them is unique. It's just specific to that night. Even though it's the same script, it's the same intention, same light cues, everything, it's always going to be just one night. And they usually film stuff like that over three nights. So that's three different audiences, three different mentalities. And the way they, we won't get into a review of the movie, but I was looking over Custom Auto stuff. And building a fighter, I think it's just such a lost art, because you're right. Like, there are three things you kind of need, and he was all about kind of putting all the pieces together, you know, the technique, the physical, you know, being conditioned, but also the mental conditioning in order to handle it. And he talks about fear and explaining why fear is necessary and like the, just the scientific process, the biological process that happens when, like Customato's vision for it, he said, for every fighter you talk about, a deer entering the clearing and then immediately sensing danger. And what happens? Your body releases adrenaline. Your heart, your blood starts pumping faster. You can have a heightened aware of things, and you can do things a little bit better than you normally can. You know, it doesn't last very long, but to be aware of that. I mean, he teaches the fighter that mental aspect, that fear is always going to be there, but this is a case of fear being good for you. Like the fighters that aren't afraid, either they're lying or something's wrong with them.
Well, you know what I liked thing. About Cus? Cus to me was the artist, and what he had is a broken up statue, and what he did is apply the right amount of clay at the right spots and places. That's how you build something.
Yeah.
You know, you got to have a foundation. From the foundation, you start building up. And a lot of times what I see, too, not just with the fighters, but trainers, is they're all looking for that lotto ticket. For instance, not even trainers do that, too. Promoters, newbies, the newbie promoters that walk into the business of boxing. 50 Cent is a prime example. He's looking for the lotto ticket. He's not really looking to develop a fighter. He's looking for that lotto ticket. He's looking for that one fighter that is going to make it right for him to be in the business. That kind of justifies, this is why I'm in the business. So he can be pat on the back and say, damn, 50, you knew exactly what you were doing, didn't you? Because right now he's not looking too good. But those are the things that I think as now, how people look at how to become an entrepreneur or how to become an athlete or get ahead in life is by taking shortcuts. You know, my dad always used to tell me, man, you know what, there's no need to do a shortcut because you're going to end up redoing it again and again and again, and it might take a little longer to get there. Do it the right way. And I think as people, as athletes, as a country, as anything, if you're a police officer, a doctor, a plumber, an actor, a radio host, doesn't matter. Always trying to do it the right way with a bit of perfection is always the way to do things, because you're going to go back and try to redo it. So why waste the time? Why waste your time? Why waste everybody else's time? I'm going to roll into Adonis Stevenson, because when we talk about molding a fighter, first off, Russ Abner, what's his name? I'm sorry, the trainer that had him before, Gabriel. Russ.
You're talking about Russ Amber? Well, Russ Amber was one of the guys that had him early on.
Amber. And really, I think that what Russ did with him early on, it's really kind of molded him to what he is today. Though Emmanuel Stewart's nephew has a hold of him, he's now pretty much trying to, you know, polish up the edges that have already been sharpened. Stevenson, it's really, to me, has looked like the student of the game. But there's a lot of things there that still need to be molded, and there's a lot of things there that still need to be, you know, dinked out and properly put in place so he can perform better and look like a much better fighter. Because here's the thing with Stevenson is, if Lou had the right, first off, he had the right game plan. Move away from the direction of his power hand. But the problem is he never tried to change direction to make Stevenson kind of get confused, which what happened with Brandon Reels with Manny Pacquiao. Manny Pacquiao didn't just go one direction when he decided to become a mover and show different angles. He went from left to right. And that's where the bomber went wrong. He didn't do any of that. He just went one direction, and what he allowed Stevenson to do was figure out the range, figure out his distance. So he never really made him think for those first three, four rounds, and he even got him in trouble a few times and he rocked him, but he never made him continuously think. And I've always said that if you're going to go in and you're going to fight somebody that's going to try to stalk you, the best way of making them stump in their game plan is to keep them thinking over and over and over and over again, that they're so focused on thinking what they need to do, they're never fluent on what they're supposed to do. And that's what saved Stevenson, because he was able to figure out his range, he was able to figure out his distance, and then we saw the ending, you know, which was a stoppage. And I give kudos in everything that he's done. I think he looks fantastic. And I also have an understanding why he's not looking for Kovalev for a fight right away. Because, you know, he's an older guy. I believe he's, what, 36 years old. He's, you know, looking, hey, I need a bank. And also with the, being on the tutelage now with Mr. Sugar Man, Manny's nephew, who was he was under Manny's banner, umbrella of trainers. He learned the school of, hey, it's better to wait sometimes than to rush and try to get all the pot at once. And I think that he could be one of the guys that are chirping in. I'm pretty sure he is, and Stevenson's there saying, hey, let's hold off. Let's go after somebody else. You know, let's go. This fight could be bigger than what right now it's talked about. And I think that's the right choice for them to do. Though, I think at the summer 2014, I think it might be enough of a wait. What do you think, Gable?
I mean, I think it's clearly the fight to make, Stevenson versus Kovalev. These two guys, it's interesting. You know, people are talking about Stevenson as a Fighter of the Year candidate. And you look at their year, and actually Kovalev, and Main Events pointed this out, arguably had the better year. I think there's probably other fighters. Sosa is one that people are talking about as a Fighter of the Year candidate. You know, if Rigondeaux gets through Agbeko and stops him, I think he's arguably a Fighter of the Year candidate. I think he's got a very live dog in front of him, and we'll get to that fight later. But this fight here, it makes sense. But it's like I understand where Stevenson's coming from. You know, I don't like his reaction. I mean, he seems to really, every time he hears the name Sergey Kovalev and do you want to fight him, he seems to balk. You know, he seems to get a little thrown, and it's visible. You can see his body kind of change and his voice kind of change. But at the same time, I understand that this is a business. And the guy's got to get done what he's got to get done. You know, I think Carl Froch is a fight that he wants, and Froch probably wants a big fight. I wonder if this is the big fight he wants. But you got to remember that, you know, the Boutte-Pascal fight is happening. A challenger will emerge out of that depending on how the fight goes, unless it's, you know, a close classic that they were expecting. Remember, there's a rematch clause for that fight, although they're allowed to take an interim fight. Would they take a dangerous fight like this with Stevenson in between? Who knows? Maybe. You know, Pascal, if he pulls – either one of those guys would be an interesting matchup for Adonis Stevenson. I think Stevenson can be had in terms of his boxing ability. I do like his discipline and his ability or willingness, certainly, to change. He will fight going backwards. He'll fight going forwards. He'll be aggressive, or he'll fight at a counterpuncher's pace. Which is what he did with Belu, or Belu. Dude had a good game plan.
Belu.
The bomber, he tried to lure Stevenson in and catch him. He caught him a few times, in fact. I thought one of those looked like a knockdown, but it wasn't. But once Stevenson figured out that was what the game was going to be, he played a different game, and he outlasted Belu. And sooner or later, you know, the bomber was going to earn his nickname again. That's what he does. He's going to get aggressive. And I think towards the middle of the fight, you know, towards the end of the fight, really, that's what happened. He kind of lost that mental game and started coming forward, letting his hands go, and Stevenson took over. I mean, I think also the thing I liked about Stevenson in the fight was the way he zeroed in. It was the third round, and they were playing the kind of waiting game and counterpunch game. And then all of a sudden, Stevenson found the rhythm, found the range, and just like the angle. And he just started unloading left hands. And there was nothing Tony Bellew could do about it. He just couldn't get out of the way of it. He'd move along the ropes, try to move his feet. He just dialed in on him, and I like that about him. I think Stevenson's a finisher, but I just don't trust his chin. He's been stopped before, and maybe he learned from it, but it was early on. I mean, I just think he can get clipped and caught. I think Kovalev is going to do it.
Yeah, unless Stevenson corrects, when he gets sloppy, he opens up. Like, he really forgets to bring his hands back to his chin. He has no footwork whatsoever.
He can
be all over the place. You know, and Kovalev just, to me, sounds like he looks like the more compact, the more controlled, the more more in terms of focus, his body's focused, just not his mind, but his body's focused. You know, he's able to control his distance. He's able to control himself to bringing himself back into balance when he throws a power punch. he's the overall much more molded guy than Stevenson. Stevenson, to me, is still a guy suited into the game, but very dangerous, very powerful. There is no denying this guy's got pop. But there's also no denying that Stevenson carries the bigger name right now, and he really has the opportunity to pick Frotch or anybody else out there at 175 to 168. He's got the drawing power right now to really talk the numbers and spark the interest of not just for the fans, but for the networks themselves to go, hey, I want to see this guy face anybody, because the names there are very viable to make. You got Frotch, you got Pascal, Boutte, it goes on. We got a very deep division in the heavier weights right now.
Oh, yeah, just forget about Hopkins. I don't think that fight happens. I think he's looking for a place to
get Hopkins, though, dude. I don't want to see it. I would watch it. I mean, listen, I tweeted it out there right after the Stevenson fight. I said, Superman versus the alien, or Superman versus the Nemesis, G.I. Joe's Nemesis, the Cobra. I don't want to see it. I want to see Superman versus his doomsday, Cobola. That's what I want to see, you know. But I would wait for that fight with Sergey for, like I said, the summer of 2014 or the beginning of 2015. Either way, it's going to be explosive. But let me tell you this, the longer Stevenson waits, it might be a little bit more dangerous for Cobola, because Stevenson, by every single fight, man, we've seen some improvement. But it's really hard. Late at 36 years old, Gable, tell me if I'm wrong, it's very hard to shake the flaws that you carry right now in your boxing career.
Yeah, I mean, it's not always, you know, A beat B, so, you know, whatever. I mean, it's not an exact science. It's styles make fights. But I look at this, and like people were talking about fight of the year for Stevenson. One of his wins is the rematch with Darnell Boone, who's the guy that knocked him out years ago in two rounds. Darnell Boone is a 500 fighter. Like, you know, he's got 20 losses. Well, Kovalev knocked that guy out like two fights before that to end his like campaign for last year, or was part of his campaign last year. It wasn't really considered anything more than a stay busy fight for him. For Stevenson, it was overcoming an obstacle, the guy that stopped him. For Kovalev, it was another day at the office and a quick one. So I tend to look at the way they're put together. And Kovalev, while he looks slow, look what he did to Ismail Salak. That guy was supposed to be super fast. Everybody was talking about the Black Russian about 5 minutes ago. And then he got stopped by Gracev, which led everybody to think that Gracev would beat Edwin Rodriguez, which he got iced in one round. Styles make fights. Again, you know, people will say that because Rodriguez couldn't beat Andre Ward, he's not a good fighter. He's going to be an action fighter. I'm still actually probably looking forward to his next fight more than Ward's on some level, depending on who Ward fights. Rodriguez was the least exciting in that Gracev fight. I mean, the Rodriguez-Ward fight was okay, but there's no knockout going to happen. I'm not very excited. But with regards to Kovalev, you know, he gauged his opponent. Most people probably scored that round for Salak. I scored a 10-10, which is rare for me, but I just thought the harder punches, when they were thrown, they seemed to land, and they were coming from Kovalev. Whereas Salak was landing some firm stuff, but it was like, get away from me punches, as opposed to, I'm going to beat you down over the next 12 rounds, which is what you got to do. And the next round, boom. I mean, Kovalev took a gander at what was in front of him, said, nothing different, nothing I can't handle, and then he knocked him out like about a minute later. That's who he is, and I think, and he did it in a technically sound way. I think he's lighter on his feet. People look at his face and go, like, this is kind of a caveman-looking Russian guy. They should be looking at his feet, which are well-schooled and kind of lighter than you think. And added to which, he knows how to bring his hands back when he throws a punch. He knows how to jab and bring his hands back. Everything is, one punch leads to the other. He lets his hands go in combination, but he's safe in doing it. And also, he's got bricks on either hand. So I just don't see how he does it.
But also could lead into his shortcomings against Stevenson, I think, because Stevenson is quick on his feet, but he seems to fumble on his feet sometimes when he gets overexcited. But if Stevenson could stay focused and stay disciplined and really work on his footwork, he can really confuse Kovalev. He can maybe even frustrate him if Kovalev can't reach him on time to return with a countless shot. It's a really interesting matchup, man. It really depends. I think it still needs to simmer. It needs to sizzle up a little bit before we put it on, take it off the grill, consuming it. But you know what? Here's the thing, too. Like, Andre Ward, you mentioned it right now, and you look at all these guys that people are already labeling the pound-for-pound. Stevenson is starting to kind of go into that pound-for-pound list. You see more and more people tweeting and talking about that this guy is the top elite level, you know, escalon of the 175-weight division. And a lot of these guys are starting to do this. They're starting to do the Mayweather roadmap of how to construct their career, which is now try to really kind of hand-pick the right decision fights, which is really part of boxing. It's not nothing new in boxing, but it's just starting to be a more of a main focus because now you have social media, and we have more of an outlet to really kind of hear the fighter be unfiltered. And unfortunately, when you know, the computer age came into play, we were able to see now the money purses, the amount, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's good for us because we get more information, but at the same time, I think it's one of those type of information we kind of wish we could have just kind of put our, you know, remember the three monkeys, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil type of deal. But we're cursed with that because this is what we wanted, more coverage, and we got it. So I'm not going to blame Steve.
Yeah, I just,
what was that?
Kind of just tripped me out. That's the second hear no evil, speak no evil monkeys reference I've had today. But beyond that, no, I think – It's the fight to make because of all the way we're going back and forth with this. You know, one guy's weaknesses may play into the others. Can he deal with the speed and athleticism, you know, an explosion of, you know, maybe Stevenson just looks Kovalev, makes Kovalev look slow off the draw all night long, you know, and it's like a Hopkins Cheeto situation. But to me, it seems like Kovalev is able to just kind of hit you with glancing blows and all of a sudden, you know, you're just, you know, doing the jab judo all over the place. You know, the way he put out Salak and staring outside of the ropes, the way he put him down like that, it's just so brutal and efficient. I mean, Stevenson, although, you know, you got to give it to him, stopping Belu on his feet, it was impressive. You know, I didn't know if he would. I kind of felt like he would. But he's knocked people out in all different kinds of ways. I mean, it just, I know economically people will say there's bigger and better fights, but I don't know. At this point,
I got to tell you, too.
Good license fee.
I like to see Rodriguez and Blue go at it. I mean, Blue, to me, showed that he's got heart. He is an intelligent fighter. He's a fighter in terms of the Morales mind frame. Is you hit me, I'm going to try to hit you twice. He has all that. And that really what really played to his not winning the victory is that when Stevenson landed something big, what did he try to do? He tried to return rather than just trying to make and create openings and counter, do a counter punches. What he was doing in the early run of the rounds, what he was doing, he was making Stevenson reach. And as soon as Stevenson reached and he saw that hand falling down to his hip, he countered and he landed. That was beautiful. But he really walked away from that game plan when Stevenson did start to like nitpick at him, graze him here and there, where he felt the oohs and the ahs of the audience. And it really just kind of picked at his ego. He was like, oh, no, I'm not going to let this dude get over on me because, one, I'm in Canada. Two, I'm not only fighting Stevenson, I'm fighting the crowd, so I got to win the crowd. And this is how I'm going to win the crowd is by returning the shots. But he shouldn't have done that. Sometimes our ego get the best of us, and it could be the downfall of what we're trying to accomplish. And that was obviously Lou's downfall, was trying to return those shots because we saw later on what happened. Stevenson was able to adjust, find his distance, land the bigger shots, and walk away with the victory with a TKO over Belu. Anyways, let's move on, man. Let's talk about some more fights here on Leaving the Ring. I don't know about you, Gary, but I think Antonio Tarver has a real big chance of becoming the next heavyweight champion of the world again. Those extra rows on him, man, just did it for me, you know. It reminded me of the old George Foreman walking back into the ring, going after Tommy Morrison and Mike, Michael Moore. And it was a nice, beautiful
shot.
but really, let's be realistic. If we're gonna compare
like
bodies,
my late career like fight night fighter, you know, the way they look, they still have like one good power punch, and you
James Toney,
yeah, you kind of have to meet out their energy because their energy doesn't work as well. You know, you've only got like three rounds in you, so you try to stretch it to like five, tire out your opponent, and then land a big one. That's kind of how that fight was. It was, like, technically sound, but it just was, like, how much percentage of Antonio Tarver do you think was there compared to the night that he knocked out Roy Jones? Like 70, 60?
Nah, not even that. I would say 60, maybe 60% was there. I mean, here's the thing, is when you're going to put him with a C-plus fighter, you're always going to look good. You're always going to look like the guy that has a strong possibility of breaking into the A-list again or the B-list. Like Brandon Rios, you know, you put a B-list fighter in again with an A-list fighter who's really kind of falling out of the A-list, but still slightly above the B. He's always going to look like the A, no matter what. With Antonio Tarver, who his body just tells you everything. Not only is he not a natural heavyweight, you can see some slippage. Is he a smart guy? Absolutely, man. You know, he's got a mouthpiece on him. He knows how to stick to his game plan. And, you know, I give it to him. He knows how to look for his shots. That uppercut came out from nowhere. He knew that it was open for him, and he went for it. That's something that we got to appreciate. But let's put him in with somebody a little bit tougher. Let's put him in with, like, a Chris the Nightmare. Let's see what he could do with Chris the Nightmare, who's not going to give you those opportunities, who's going to close the gap, who's going to be all over you, and really see if you can carry those extra pounds that you're carrying around right now at 220. That's what I want to see. You know, even a Seth Mitchell, who's got a weak chin, proven over and over, if he touches it, he's going to fall apart. But he's got that power. He's got that power, and he's got that recklessness where he's going to test you just a bit to see exactly where you are, where you're at, you know. So that's where I'm at with him, with Antonio Tarver. It was good to see him come back, though, but I don't see him getting any further than, like, a Fox Sports channel. I mean, maybe
he's
a Showtime New Generation.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he's 45 years old. Showbox, the old generation. at this level, I mean, you know, Mike Shepard was, what, 21? 15-1, and by the third round, I mean, you know, by the fourth round, where he got dropped three times, didn't he look like a guy that had picked a fight with the wrong person at a restaurant? I mean, he just seemed very much out of his league. He didn't really want much more. The ref should have stopped it much sooner, I thought. I think that's the level he's going to be at. Like you said, get somebody young and hungry that's going to push the pace. I mean, say, like, even like a Brian Jennings, you don't even think he's, like, a dangerous puncher. Or what would Mike Perez do with that version of Antonio Tarver?
But Andy, what would Andy Rios do to him, you know?
Another
name out there.
He eats too many shots, I think. Andy's got to lose the weight. You know, early on it was cool that he was a chubby kid who could fight a bit and had lost a lot of weight. Like, he dropped at least, you know, a sixth grader in the time that I knew him, a wild card. But after a while, you know, are you going to be a world-class athlete or are you going to be a second-tier guy that carries some weight and jiggles and you can't really move your upper body quite as good as you can move your feet? You've got to make a decision. And, you know, it is his body type. He's never going to be, like Steve always says, on the cover of Muscle and Fitness. But he's still got to get a little better than he is. You know, he's got to find something else. Because that last fight, he was taking shots that he just shouldn't. Well, Tor Hammer, people can say what they want about him, that he quit. A fighter knows when he's done, and I know he's done it two times in a row. Maybe he needed two times to know it's over. But Tor, he got a solid offense. He fired back. You know, he's got good technique. He could have been, I think, a better fighter than he was or has been had he started much younger and maybe been more focused on that than other things. But Andy getting hit and flushed like that over and over again, it was the first time I kind of said, all right, you stepped up to, like, a different level. At the very least, Tor Hammer won prize fighter. And when you step up to that level, it's like, dude, I wouldn't step up any more levels until you get your conditioning in order and you get yourself a little more elusive or you learn some better defense, because his career is not going to last much longer taking shots like that.
No, I agree. I agree, man. Fight fans, you want to call in, you certainly can. It's 347-215-7598. Let's talk some boxing here on Leaving the Ring. Yeah, it's Friday. We're not doing a Thursday show, as you obviously already know. Hey, don't forget to download the mobile app to your Android or your Apple. Just got to go to your Google Store or your Apple Store and download us. And be sure to tune in every Monday. You got the next round with Steve Kim and yours truly there, Mr. Gabriel, the Dark Cloud Montoya. I don't know about the Golden Gate there, nickname there, buddy, but I'm going to stick with the Dark Cloud. And listen, every week, I know I keep saying we're going to be putting the Spanish radio show on the app. I just talked to the app developer, and, you know, they're just really behind on stuff because they're so swamped, you know, holidays as well. Hey, everybody's got to, you know, make their money and, you know, take care of business in their life. But they're going to be on really soon this weekend, which is Tijuana Boxeo Radio. Hey, man, these guys, if you haven't listened to them, they're on our website on Leaving the Ring. Go and check out their older past week episodes. And I got to tell you, if you're Spanish-speaking and you love Espanol and you will love boxing and you want to put it all in one and you want to be able to chill and listen to Leaving the Ring and then go into the next round but then say, you know what, I still need a little bit more of a fix, so I'm going to go into my Chicano mode, Mexicano mode. You tune into Tijuana Boxeo Radio, and I'm telling you, they're going to fulfill the need, man. It's a really great show, really, really great show by two really good guys. Anyways, let's talk about Flach here. Gabe, I want to hear your opinion, man, about that fight, the controversial decision, the stoppage. Break it down. What are your thoughts? Let's catch up with all these past fights.
I thought George Groves was doing great. I thought he knocked him out in that first round. It looked like just a home run punch. Credit to Frotch. I mean, he's just a flat-out warrior. The way he's able to get up, keep coming back. He seemed like he was angry just as he was hitting the canvas. He gets back up, and he just – what I found interesting about the fight was that it looked like Groves was just running away with it. Most people look at it like Groves just absolutely had it. And in many respects, he did, but it was – almost like Chavez Meldrick Taylor in that the little shots that Frotch was getting in, body shot here, you know, like right to the solar plexus. Or he slowly exacted like a toll that wore down Groves. By the end of it, the kid was just kind of falling all apart. He'd never been in this kind of territory before. It was his first title shot. He's in deep territory, and he's winning against, a wily champion. That said, I mean, he's not the one that had to get off the canvas, Groves. He got hurt, but if you watch that final round, he's fighting his way through it. He gets to the ropes, and he takes some shots and some hard ones inside, but he's coming forward. He's got his guard up, and he's kind of disappearing into his guard as the referee came in to stop it. I just didn't see – it reminded me of Kirkland Molina watching the tape where – the fight looked like it was about to happen. Like in that movie Heaven Can Wait, you know, where Warren Beatty's in the tunnel and he's about to get hit by the van, and so Buck Henry pulls him out before he dies. He doesn't let the outcome happen. And in this case, the ref just kind of jumped the gun. Sort of like with Molina. It was like, yeah, the guy stepped in the ring, but, you know, Kirkland was maybe on his way to stopping him, or Molina was on his way to winning the fight. And we were going to go in two different paths, but instead there was no clear ending, and just the ref intervened and cut it off. I think it demands a rematch. I'd be curious. I tend to think that Groves would do better and maybe end things sooner, because I thought he had Frotch hurt all throughout. But
the ref was an idiot.
But then he fell apart.
I got to be honest. The ref was an idiot. He just got overzealous. He didn't, you know, I mean – you step in with Guy Groves, who was doing fantastic, and you're absolutely right. I think the stubbornness of Frotch going in, and this is the thing, too. Like, you know, there a lot of folks, highway robbery, it was clear that Groves was winning. Look, to me, it was a very competitive fight. It was one guy that had fast hands, one guy that was there to prove that he's one of the best fighters in the world, which was Groves, and the other guy that just doesn't want to let go of the glory that he's already obtained by his fans. And two guys are going in there. They're putting in a great display of boxing, a great display of courage, a great display of stubbornness between the both of them, and it was ruined by the ref. But was this a Chris John versus Diaz type of fight? I mean, not Diaz, Rocky Juarez type of fight where it was clear that Chris John won? No, it wasn't. This was really a fight where both guys were having a teeter-totty type of back-and-forth fight, and you could give one round to one guy and another round to another dude. But it also, but it left us with, we want more. We need more. Give us the fight that obviously that we're hoping to get, which was, it really looked like Frotch was coming back into his own. It really looked like he was, that his pressure was just taking over Groves. But we don't know what would have happened in those last few rounds left. We don't know if Groves would adjust. We don't know if Jones could have got a second win, and he might have came back going, nope, I'm taking it all. We don't know that, because Frotch showing me in that first round is that become comfortable believing he's the bigger puncher. He's become comfortable believing he's the bully in the ring, and everybody's going to be afraid of him, especially what he did with Butte. And guess what? He paid for it in that first round. Groves showed him, I'm not afraid of you. We're both going to play in this playground, and you're just going to have to accept it.
Well, I think, you know, where they go from here, to me, it's the same situation at 75. They should go right back at each other. You know, and Kovalev and Stevenson should fight each other.
I don't see that happening. I don't think Frost is going to want it. I don't think Frost wants it.
No, he doesn't want it.
No.
You know, he doesn't want it.
He doesn't want it.
It's going to be hard for Groves to move forward from this moment, because he's always going to question what I've been able to get through it. And the marketing, say you're Andre Ward and you're looking for a guy to fight. Do you fight the guy that got stopped by Frotch? How do you take that fight? You know, I don't think he's looking for
right.
it, but, and I think it's an interesting matchup. And if he was able to state his case and say, well, I stopped Carl Frotch, or I beat Carl Frotch and did it in very decisive fashion, let's fight. Everybody would have said yes. Now it's just kind of hard to market without doing it again. So it'll be interesting going forward. I'm not sure exactly, but, I'm not going to prognosticate on the business of it.
Right. Just like Frotch, he's really got the market power right now to kind of decide which way, what direction he's going to want to go with his career. With Groves, it's almost a mental thing for any fighter that's going to start questioning. Obviously, he's out there, and he believes, he's tweeting it out today, he's the winner, watch the fight, what are you talking about, you're an idiot, you think that he won. Whatever the case is. That always stings the pride of a fighter, because that's another thing that fighters are built on, pride. If you're not confident and you don't truly believe that you could win and you're indestructible, then you have no business to be a fighter, because that's something you need. That's something that has to be added to the fire to be a prize fighter. So, and that's the key word, prize fighter. Frost, is it smart for him to go back with Groves? I don't think so. I think what he's going to have to do is take a step back and probably watch the Butte and Pascal fight, and then maybe try to pick at that fight and get the winner of those two guys, and then try to rebuild back his confidence and let Groves, which is really, it's sad because now Groves is really left outside, out in the cold. He's really the guy that's going to be looking in. And that sucks. That's the fight game for you. So, did Frotch lose fans? I don't think so. Did he piss off, did the ref piss off a lot of fans? Absolutely. But just like anything else, fans are going to forget by the next month. Rolling to January 2014, everybody forgot about what happened with Frotch and Groves, and everybody's going to be calling for Frotch to either step up or get the winner of Lucian Butte and Sean Pascal. So that's what I see. I don't think nobody wants to see the Ward fight. I mean, Frotch don't want to see that Ward fight. You've heard what he's had to say in the past. He said he's boring. And Ward, you know, responded by saying, yeah, you know, you're going to criticize the style you can't dominate or you can't beat or you can't figure. So I think that's what's going to happen with Groves. He's going to say, I beat him. I knocked him out. He's got to fight somebody to spark some more interest so that it makes more sense. See, that's what he's going to be telling himself. That's what his team's going to be whispering in his ear. You knocked him out, champ. Why go through that again?
Yeah, I mean, it's a matter of you got through the challenge, so let's just get the hell out of here. Yeah, he doesn't really need it.
I mean, he got burned. He just didn't get that one degree burn, you know. He got burned enough. So they're like, no, let's not do it. Let's move on. Let's see something for bigger and better. I mean, if you're going to get knocked out and beat, let's wait to see what Stevenson's going to do, you know, because that fight would potentially be a massive fight, no matter where it goes. Canada, England, doesn't matter. That's a pay-per-view for the fans out there. Not here in the States. but up there. You know, if Stevenson had Antonio Tarver's mouthpiece, oh God, he'd be a superstar here in the States already. You know, a mouthpiece with that kind of power and recklessness, dude, he's a star. All right, fans, you want to call in 347-215-7598? Certainly can. Let's talk some boxing here on Leaving the Ring. Hey, man, let's move on to some predictions. Move on to some predictions that are happening. We've got a lot of predictions to make, especially for tonight on Show Block New Generation. And then you got Showtime, and then you got HBO. I mean, we're stacked, man. If you're a fight fan, you're in heaven. I'm in heaven right now, Gabriel. So let's talk about some fights here. Let's make some predictions. Let's break it down. Let's see who's the winner, who's not the winner, and then find out after the weekend who didn't get the right pick.
All right, so let me pull up the fight schedule. You want to start with tonight's fights? I mean, they're only a few hours away. J-Lo.
Yeah, let's start.
These fights are really, you know, they're not, I wouldn't even call them that competitive. It's
just kind of an appetizer
for Showbox. Yeah, this is
that's
the TNT obligation. It's Mickey Bay, Jaylion Love, and Badu Jack versus Carlos Cardenas, Raleo Medina, and Luan Simon. I'm just going to go with the chalk across the board on that and just move straight to Barclays Center in Brooklyn, New York on Showtime as well. Zab Judah versus Paulie Malignaggi. Who do you got?
Between Zab Judah and Paul Malignaggi?
Yeah, for the
Brooklyn,
King of New York, the King of Brooklyn.
Who would be the key? Right, King of Brooklyn. You know, it's funny. Back in 2004, I believe, or 2005, I made a video of both those guys that how they should meet each other to figure out who's the King of Brooklyn. And that was back in 2004, 2005, like I said, where at that time it really made a lot of sense because these guys were really at the edge of their career. They needed a big money payday. They were really kind of just being thrown around between promoters and networks, and they didn't really have a home, you know. And it almost seemed like the landscape of boxing has kind of deserted them. So that fight made sense. But now you have Paulie Malignaggi, who's more of a commentator for Showtime, and Zab Judah has been more vocal. He's been following the roots of Paulie Malignaggi in terms of calling out the bad, you know. Pointing out the corruption of boxing. And he's really sparked the interest. You know, he's become one of the poster boys to say, this is wrong. This shouldn't happen in boxing. These promoters are doing us. They're not doing us by right in what they're doing. And to me, even with the fights where Zab Judah getting older, slower, and even more conservative with his punches and not as reckless as he used to be, you know, he doesn't have that hip-hop pizzazz about him anymore. He's become more of a band boy, group theme singer, you know. He's loud outside the ring, but once he gets in that ring, he's kind of like, okay, I need to do a show. But it looks good, and it's worked for him, you know. He's been winning. He did really good against Danny Garcia, but it still wasn't enough. With Paulie Malignaggi, this guy had a lot of flamboyant. Well, the flamboyant has just really disappeared. The tires on Paul Malignaggi have really flattened, where Paulie's got to now rely on what he's always known, which is the basics of boxing, and it's been working. But it hasn't been enough. When he fought Pablo Cano, it wasn't enough, you know. And when they robbed Pablo from that fight and gave it to Paulie Malignaggi, we didn't see the same parade that Paulie had that you're hearing now, calling everybody fanboys. The media's are fanboys and et cetera, et cetera. We'll get a little to that a little later. But both guys have maintained themselves, kept themselves out there. They've marketed themselves correctly, so they're still in the eyes of fight fans. But what is the importance of this fight? In all honesty, Gabriel, to me, I really don't care. But I tell you what it really is for, because if you listen to the terms, the wordings that they're saying, like, you know, I'm pound for pound. This only sets me up for a big fight. Well, we all know that Floyd's going to be signing a fight, maybe, hopefully. Well, not hopefully. I hope he doesn't. Maybe I'm hoping I'm wrong. Amir Khan. But after that, he's got what then? Three more fights? And those three more fights, who are they going to be with? So Golden Boy's got to create. They got to create a fight for him. They got to create a fight that is really another page ripped out of Floyd Mayweather, which we've called him, I've called him for many years, the Houdini of boxing. They got to rip a page from him and sell it to the audience, sell it to the mainstream fans that Zab Judah, who fought Floyd Mayweather many, many years ago, is ready now because he's more mature to face Floyd Mayweather. Amir Khan, who was on his way out, has rejuvenated, and he's rebuilt himself that now he's the guy to get in there and fight Floyd Mayweather. That's what this fight's really, really about, in my opinion. It's about who's the guy next in line, because there's not nobody else out there for Floyd Mayweather to be a threat, but they need to fill in that fight slot and fight date that Showtime signed on with Floyd Mayweather. So who wins this fight? Dude, I'm going to tell you who wins this fight. My pick is going to be Paulo Malignaggi. His work rate is a lot more. He's going to let his hands go. He's going to get clipped. He knows how to take a beating. But they both swell up. I mean, it's really up to these old faces, man, how well they're going to hold up to each other's punches. Zab's got to throw a lot more punches. But Zab does carry the pop. But nobody's been really able to stop Paulo Malignaggi. So we know he's got a good jaw. It really depends on his jaw. Is it just decided to finally just roll over and belly up this Saturday night? I highly doubt it. And with the high that Paulie has of him believing that he beat Broner, and a lot of folks believe that he did beat Broner, I think he's going to go in there with the fast talking and the fast hands. The slow foot is not going to be there. He doesn't have his footwork there. He can't rely on that. But lucky for him, that neither does Zab. But Zab does still have fast hands, but it's spurts. It's only one punch at a time. It's not a combination like he used to do. The way we saw him when he stunned Costa Zoo, when he did Vernon Phillips, that's not the same Zab Judah that we're used to seeing. We're seeing more of the slow down. Hey, I like listening to hip hop, but it's got to be at volume 10. Don't blast it. Don't bump the speakers. You know what I'm saying? I like to cruise it. I like to do things slow, low. That's Zab Judah now. So I'm picking Paulo Malignaggi by unanimous decision.
I wonder about it because I like the idea of volume over what Judah does. I mean, Judah's going to be looking to get back in the game at some point in this fight. I think he's going to be down, like you said. He's going to get outboxed. He's going to get outworked at long distance. But he kind of figured something out in the back end of the Garcia fight, and maybe that was his Froch Groves, where he kind of waited for the young kid to do all the work and do things early. But he also got dropped late in that fight, in I think the eighth round, got up, and then hurt Danny Garcia a few rounds later. Zab's still got a lot left in the tank. I think at 47, he's still staying in shape, but not having to sacrifice all that much. I think both guys are kind of right there. But I tend to think that Zab stays in better shape than Paulie. Paulie's enjoying being a TV commentator. And while he does make the sacrifices, both of them looked in tremendous shape today. They certainly weren't guys stealing money and looking all chubby. They both made the weight, and they probably had to drain a little bit to do it. But still, I tend to look at fight.
But here's the problem, though, is that Paulie, look, to me, a guy that's really on their way out, slowly and gradually, they end up just kind of not coming to the gym anymore. They don't surround themselves with fight people anymore. They don't surround themselves with the fights. They don't surround themselves being in the events, the atmosphere of boxing. And they just slowly kind of disappear. With Paulo Malignaggi being a commentator, and if you look at most of the commentators like Bobby Che to Roy Jones, they really fall late in the retiring because they're around it. And if they feel this, if I can call it and still see the flaws and catch it, perform it. And that's what I think a lot of people forget, that just because you can see it doesn't necessarily you can apply to do what you're thinking, because your body has a different reaction. The body has a different thought than your mind. Your brain is a lot quicker than your reflexes. So, you know, I think that's where Paulie Malignaggi's at, where it's hard for him to walk away from it. And he's sitting there, and he's calling these fights, and I think he really truly believes, well, I could call this, and I'm intelligent enough to see, you know, what this guy brings to the table, and I can have a plan, and if I can call it and talk about it and sound intellectual about it, I obviously can perform it. And I think that's where Paulo Malignaggi stands right now, where Zab, I think he's fighting to eat. Two different things. But I could be wrong.
I think it is boxing. There's a few things at play here. also, you have to remember that, that Paulie just signed with Mayweather or with Heyman. Everybody's Heyman. On this entire card is essentially in the Mayweather sweepstakes. Not everyone, but Paulie Malignaggi, Jab Judah, Devin Alexander, Sean Porter. To some extent, maybe Lara and Trout, but probably not. And so you have to look at those guys and say, I think this one is certainly they're fighting for one of those slots next year, maybe the first one. I think if Jab Judah wins this fight and stops Paulie, the next fight we get is Mayweather versus Jab Judah 2.
I believe that.
Without question.
You know, because it's a good start.
To be by stopping.
And
I don't think that's going to happen. I just so like you said, like, you know, Paulie's got a good chin. He's taken worse beatings than are going to be doled out on Saturday. Yeah, he's older. The TV commentator thing bothers me. He seems comfortable. But I liked where he was at in his last fight, although he's kind of followed a pattern of being up and then being down. He was up for the fight that he won the title belt in. And I don't want to screw the guy's name up. But his next fight against Cano, he was down. And I thought he lost that fight. Everybody thought he lost that fight. Sinchenko. He stopped him in 9 rounds, and he looked great. But then, yeah, the next fight, he looked really flat. Against Broner, he didn't look so flat. I thought he looked very good. I'm curious
and
to
that's
see
what my
if he's going to squeeze out a little more juice from the grape in this fight, you know?
Exactly. But, you know, that's where my assessment comes from is from that Broner fight. Because, look, am I going to say that Zab fights like Broner? No, not entirely, but there are some images that you can take a snapshot and go, wow, him, Broner, and Zab do a lot of the same things. One is, you know, Broner's not a guy that throws a lot of punches. He looks like an older Floyd Mayweather that just can't seem to mimic him completely and do what Floyd does because Floyd is Floyd, and Floyd is a much, much more smarter fighter than Broner. But
yeah.
Broner, he took his time. He looked for his shot. He tried to be the quicker guy with one shot here and there.
He took too
and
much
that really,
time.
He
much
took
time
way too much
fight.
Time. And Zap has the tendency of doing the same thing. Not as much, but he does. You know, where Zap needs to be in the right position. But here's the other thing about Zap Judah too, where when in terms of guys that are not mentally there, that are not mentally stable. When we think about guys that fall apart under pressure, we think about Victor Ortiz. But if we go before Victor Ortiz, Jab Judah was the first guy you would think of. Doesn't know how to respond if he's not getting his way. Acts like a spoiled brat in the ring. And he might more or less end up doing that. Did he do it really with Danny Garcia? Probably not. But that was because Danny was a stronger puncher.
His last couple performances have been very mature. I think Zab's past that point, you know, and even I think to some extent.
Is he, though, Gabriel? Come on. Is he? He's fighting a guy right now that he knows can't punch. He's fighting a guy right now that he knows he's quicker than.
Are we talking about him?
And when you
rattling?
Go Winder.
I even just go back to him, like the Mayweather thing. I think a lot of people blame him for that, but that fight should have ended on disqualification, you know, if any fight should have. You know, and his low blow, I tend to think it wasn't that as bad. You know, the rabbit punch was lame, but the ref hadn't stopped to come in and done anything. I mean, those things happen. As we've seen, history's shown us Floyd makes a big deal when he gets fouled in order to get the ref involved. He always does that. I think the rap on that he's weak-minded, I think he runs out of answers. I don't think he's weak-minded. I think he runs out of answers, and he's very pattern-based, and he's very simple as a fighter. He's got that uppercut. He's got the left. You really aren't worrying too much about the right
He does have the jab. He does have the jab.
He does.
Because, you know,
when
he throws,
he
throws that jab, he's good at it. Right.
When he does.
Right.
Yeah.
When he does it. When he does it.
More often than not, though, it's like a Southpaw Mosley sometimes, with better defense.
But in terms of being thick and in the mud, I haven't seen him happen. Really happen. When he fought Lucas Matisse and when he fought Danny Garcia, he really understood that he was the older guy and that he had to be the mover, that he had to be the boxer. With this fight, this is a change of role for him. This is him really going back to his youth days where he was the stalker. He was the power puncher with the speed. And I'm wondering if that's the mind frame he's coming in, or is he coming in the way he did in fighting spirit and fighting game plan the way he did with Matisse or Garcia? I don't think so. So that's why I'm saying we really don't know where his mind frame is. Can he be exhausted? Can he get frustrated? Can he run out of answers? And what does he do when those things happen to him? Because obviously he knew that he was not going to have the answers for Garcia or Lucas Matisse, but he stuck to that game plan because that was a satisfying game plan that he knew that was realistic to gain a win. With Paulo Malignaggi, this is something different. He's fighting a different beast. He's not fighting the same guy, a guy with claws. He's fighting a guy with paws.
Yeah, it's an interesting fight. I mean, people have kind of dogged it. I think of the weekend fights, this isn't one that I would put on the list of fights that just don't move me, because I actually think something interesting could happen in this. Both guys
it's
are faded
interesting. It's interesting, but we could have really, honestly, we could have done without it. Let's be honest. It's one of those type of fights. It's one of those like, hey, it's good it's happening, but it's not one that we're like, dude, we got to see this happen. It's got to be made. It wasn't one of those.
It's just kind of, I mean, if I was going to name this card, I mean, well, the Devin Alexander-Sean Porter fight is an interesting fight because it moves another
that's
guy
more
in
of an
position. But,
fight.
But overall, like top to bottom, if I had to name this card, I'd call it tax deductible because that's what it feels like. Although, you know, there's some hidden gems. I mean, Julian Williams, he's trained by Stephen Edwards. He's a kid that I think is one to watch. He's kind of a scary junior middle. And, you know, if I'm at 154 pounds I'm fighting on HBO, I'm glad that he's fighting on Showtime because that guy's a problem. He's going to be a problem down the line. Saki Obika versus Anthony Durrell, yeah, there's a fight. Honestly, if you threw it at me while it was on fire, I probably would care about that. Other than that, that fight just I think it's going to be ugly. I think it's going to be slow. I think it's going to be a grinding 12 rounds. I'll go with Bika, but that fight,
You're talking about Anthony and Zyko Bika? I'm sorry. I was tweeting something back. Are we talking about that fight here? My apologies.
Nope, that fight's booty. It's going to go 12 rounds. It's going to be ugly. I'm going Bika.
You know, I'm going with Bika, too. I talked to a few folks, and they were like, no, I'm going to go with Durrell. My thing with Anthony Durrell is, you know, he just got over the cancer, what, about a year ago, I believe, or a little bit more, maybe two. He was kind of out of the ring. You know, we really didn't know what was happening with him. Where the Scorpion, he was staying active. Was he winning? No. But he was active, and he was fighting some of the top tiers out there. So, to me, he's more of the more guy that you have to look at in terms on paper. He's the guy that makes more sense for that night to be the winner. So, I'm going with him. I think that being who Psycho Bika is a very rugged, strong fighter, and he could do really nice, subtle things in the inside. That's what's going to give Durrell a lot of problems, you know. Durrell's going to need to be on his feet. He's got to be, you know, more. He's got to be the boxer. And I don't know if he has the skills or the fundamentals to keep Bika off of him. I don't think he could do that, man. I think Bika is just going to be all over him, and he's not going to make it look like a pretty fight. He's not going to make him have his way. He's going to rough and tumble him, man. So I'm going to go with Bika. I think go 12 rounds. Like you said, I think same thing. I'm going to go split decision, though.
I mean, this could be even more brutal to watch. Devin Alexander versus Sean Porter. Welterweights, 12 rounds, IBF title on the line. Alexander's IBF title. I like this fight, and I think it's going to be more fluid, a little more dangerous than Bradley versus Alexander, which I know isn't that hard because it was an awful fight. But I think the matchup is kind of similar, and I think Porter, he understands exactly who he is. He's a man with low center of gravity. He's the shorter guy, but he's stout. He goes to the body very well. He's going to get underneath, and he's going to work inside. And I think he's going to physically match up with Alexander better than Alexander wants him to. I like Alexander. I think he's a fine boxer, but he's kind of a 1-2 guy, mixes in a 3 every now and again. But just kind of, to me, is I don't know if he's died on the vine, but the milk has gone a little bad. I just don't think he's quite the fighter he was at 140. And I wasn't really that sold on him then. So I like the work that John Porter's getting with James Kirkland, Demetrius Andrade. Those are real people that you want to be working with in order to prepare for a guy as slick and with the wheels of Alexander. But I think it's a work rate thing. I think Alexander breaks him down in the first half of the fight, or at least softens him up. Doesn't finish him, but I think has his way deep into the fight. For a
work rate is the key. Work rate is the word that right now that I was going to use when it comes to Sean Porter. This guy is putting in the work rate. He's putting in the correct sparring, which is not sparring guys that are smaller than him. He's sparring guys that are bigger than him. Not only are they bigger than him, they're skilled. They're at a skill level. The other thing I like, too, is that Joel Diaz, who's the trainer of Timothy Bradley, who Bradley beat Devon Alexander, and Joel Diaz is the one that came up with the game plan to beat Devon Alexander at 140. He came into camp to give him some pointers and to help out Sean Porter. When you talk about spoiled milk, well, how does spoiled milk happen? When you leave it out there too long and it does nothing with it. You don't put it back in the refrigerator. It just gets spoiled. It's no longer any good. And that's what Devon Alexander's career has been kind of for a short time. You know, he's been, you know, called, he's going to fight Cal Brook, he's going to fight this person, and everything, not because of him, have fallen apart. So it's left him out there to be spoiled. And that is a big problem. When you're going to go in there with a guy like Sean Porter, who fought Kid Diaz twice, on the first one was a competitive fight, second one he redeemed himself, but he's been consistent and he's being busy, well, you're going to have problems because this kid not only is putting in the work, but he's putting in that work rate what Timothy Bradley was like when Devon Alexander stepped into the ring. And that's volume. That's a guy that's going to come at you and a guy that's going to be fluent. And that's what really troubles Devon Alexander. Even if he's up to par, if you are fluent and you have volume and you throw a lot of punches and you give him angles, he's going to have problems. And now that he's spoiled, dude, I really don't expect him to go the full 12 rounds. I see a stoppage by Sean Porter.
Wow. Well, and even that, remember, you know, Alexander was inactive. So was Bradley. They put that fight on ice in order to preserve it for some reason. It's like one of the series of some of the worst decisions of all time. This fight, it's going to be, I mean, is it going to be a coming out party for Alexander? I don't know, because he's a trippy dude. You know, I wasn't totally sold on him. I'm still not totally sold on him. I like his attitude. I like him and his dad.
I don't think anybody's high on Alexander, to tell you the truth. To me, it's just going to be a good win for him, and then we see where he goes from there. I mean, you beat Alexander at 147. Big deal. What has Alexander done at 147? And I'm knocking that, you know, what Sean Porter and his team are doing, but the reality is that it's, you got to beat somebody that's invaluable to become valuable to the division. And beating Alexander, who hasn't accomplished diddly, doesn't put you in that position.
Yeah, I disagree. I think if it depends on how he does it. And he's going to pick up a belt, so he's going to become a player. But if he's able to stop him, I mean, certainly I think that's going to be impressive. I don't think he stops him, though. And I think Porter, to me, is going to be like a Tim Bradley. He's going to have to chop away at a giant tree of respect, you know, in order to get it. It's Alexander, you're absolutely right. At 147, he hasn't really done much. He's picked up a belt, but it hasn't been very exciting. To me, it's like a quiet belt holder, you know. And
it's not entirely his fault. It's not really entirely his fault, but it's the business of boxing sometimes.
I think it's the style. You know, when he was sold to be, I mean, a lot of people made a big deal about him off the Arango fight. And that was kind of like the high water mark, wouldn't you say? Because everything else
right
after that was fights that we felt he lost. You know, Kotelnik, Matisse, and what else? You know, and then the Bradley fight where a fight he actually lost. Everything else has been, I mean, I guess the Maidana fight was a good fight. A solid fight, but Maidana, you know, is a guy that's lived off of beating Ortiz for a long time and hurting Amir Khan. But he's, you know, he's a plug-inable action fighter. But yeah, I mean, the Randall Bailey fight. I mean, can you think of a moment that's excited you about Devon Alexander in a long time? I can't. And on top of it, he's coming off an injury, you know, with the hand. So, yeah, I think everything adds up for very well for Sean Porter in this fight. I think he's a guy that's feeling it confidence-wise, the work he's getting. He's traveling, trying to get better work, trying to get better. I think his conditioning is going to be great. He looked in very good shape the day he worked with Kirkland. They both did, but he was more acclimated to the space. I mean, the floor there is super spongy. It's such a problem that I think it did have an effect. But there's no question. If you ever – you've been undisputed. That ring is just – it's a trip. It's like walking in – kind of like the sand closest to the ocean in that it's hard-packed, but it still gives. It's like that, but a whole boxing ring. And you keep making those depressions in it. Your foot literally sinks into the canvas. And after two rounds, you could see Kirkland being very tired. But Sean Porter did a lot of work in that ring. So that was some good work that he did. But then, you know, he did, when you get onto a regular surface, you become super fast. So I expect Sean to be explosive in this fight, better than he was in the Diaz rematch. I don't think he stops him, but I think it's a good, solid outing, and it'll be one of the better fights on the card. Here's the one that's really, I think, incredibly tough to pick. Arisandi Lara versus Austin Trout, junior middleweights, 12 rounds.
That's actually the fight there that I think is going to be the fight of the night, and I know some folks are saying it's going to be boring. I don't think it is, to tell you the truth.
I agree with you.
You break it down. You break it down what you think, and I'll come right behind you.
Well, I just think, you know, well, Lara is a guy that with his last fight, you know, with Angulo, like, all over him, he didn't perform very well. I mean, and I think both guys are people that need space to work, Trout and Lara. The couple of counterpunchers, although I have a feeling in this fight that Trout's going to lead, and he's going to be more comfortable leading, and that's going to be a problem for him. I think, you know, the Cuban shoots straighter, shoots harder, and is physically very strong, and I think maybe the stronger man in this fight. He seems more comfortable, Lara, fighting physically, grappling, holding, tying you up on the inside and still being able to work. At this stage, I think, you know, between the two of them, I know Carlos Molina gave Lara a lot of problems, but still, I think for them to get their best work done, they like to be out in space, like mid-range, kind of getting the other guy in the end of their power. I think they're both going to be looking to do that, and because of that, it's going to be a very explosive fight. I don't think of Trout as the power puncher here. I think of Lara as the power puncher. And so I think he's going to do a lot of damage. Can he stop Trout? I don't know, but can he put him down? I think he will. So I'm leaning towards Lara by decision.
You know, when Austin Trout fought Saul Canelo, I said that if Trout had Kirkland or Angulo's power, because he certainly fought like them, he was a buzzsaw, he could have possibly stopped Canelo or definitely had beat him, where Canelo wouldn't respond with counter shots. But Austin Trout doesn't have that type of power. He does have the volume in his arsenal. He does know how to come forward, and he's certainly a fearless type of fighter. He's not afraid of what's going to come at him. When you think of Lara versus Angulo, well, a lot of people don't like to recognize or give credit to what Lara was doing inside those rounds. Angulo was definitely beating him, landing the bigger, harder shots. But in between those combinations, Lara was countering. And slowly and surely, in each round, he was breaking Angulo, breaking him apart. And that, I think, is what we're going to see again. We're going to see Trout on top of Lara, outpointing him. But then what we're going to see is the telling blows of Lara. The thing is, I don't know if Trout has Angulo's chin or Angulo, he might have Angulo's will, but is he going to be able to withstand these power counter shots from Lara to keep going? Or is he going to revert to a different style, which is start walking backwards? Because Angulo certainly did it. What he did is when he decided to walk backwards, it was to walk back to his corner and call quits. And that's why I think that Lara, in my opinion, is going to be down on the cards with the judges, where Trout's going to be up because they're going to be scoring the volume of punches, and the punches they're going to be landing on Lara are going to be hard to count in the big shots that Lara is going to land, those counter shots. But then those later rounds is going to come in, and I think those one or two shots in each round that Laura lands, in each one of those rounds where he makes those punches count, it's gonna come into a major play, and he's gonna end up stopping Austin Trout because he's not gonna see it coming in those late rounds, and I think it's gonna be a TKO for Arison Lotti. So I'm gonna pick Laura by stoppage, man. I like Trout, but I just don't think that he has the power to keep Laura back. And for Laura to quit and the power to stop, you know, Arison Lotti, Laura. I think Laura has the power. He just doesn't have the volume. He doesn't have that work rate, you know, but that's okay because his counter punching is being so precise, it works for him. And that's what's made him one of the best and most dangerous 154 pounders to date.
I think it's a solid pick. You're right. He doesn't need to be aggressive because Trout's going to be. And then he's going to find the seams in between. Stop him. That's a solid pick. Moving over to HBO, Boardwalk Hall, Atlantic City, New Jersey. On HBO, Guillermo El Jackal, the Jackal Rigondeaux, versus Joseph King Kong Agbeko, and that is actually his name, King Kong. Super bantamweight, 122 pounders for 12 rounds for Rigo's WBA and WBO 122-pound titles. I like Rigo in this fight. But I think it's a very dangerous fight. Agbeko is a taller man. He's got the longer, seemingly longer reach. He's got a good right hand. It's an awkward right hand and a chopping right hand. But it does leave a little bit of space to come down the middle. It's going to be incumbent on Rigo to not be waiting for him to be done with it or to be, you know, but be catching him when he's beginning it in order to land his left hand. But Rigo's got power in both hands. He's got tremendous boxing acumen. He's a smaller guy, but he knows how to be. And to me, he's still on the ups. He's only got, a dozen fights. Whereas Agbeko, I don't know. I don't know where he's at, you know. Is he going to be in great shape? He's been kind of quiet. He was very, very confident at the press conference and jubilant. But, it's been a while since he's won at the top level. You know, he lost back-to-back fights to Abner Morris, who's no slouch, you know, won that tournament. And did beat Agbeko to do it. He had the fights back-to-back with Johnny Perez. He avenged the loss in a rematch. He's got a long road here, you know, and to start it all off, it was Victor Chinian. So what does he have left? Who knows? He's been off for a while. He's only fought once this year. He didn't fight at all in 2012. So is he, you know, and remember he had back problems. Is his back completely healed? Was that where he was? I don't know. No one really, really broached that. So it'd be interesting to see where he goes, how he goes about his business in this fight. Does he come out firing? Does he take some time? Does rust show? We'll see. But I tend to think that Agbeko, being from Ghana, being just a tough champion, he's never been stopped, though he has four losses. And it's not like he's very far removed from fighting at the world championship level. I think he's going to make a good showing. I think he's got a good chance to win, but I like Rigo by decision. I just think he's the better overall fighter. The way he moves, he's very confident. He has had trouble with guys that won't go away, guys with chins and with good right hands. So this fight should be interesting, especially if Agbeko starts to work the left end of things. But I'm just going with Rigo. I just think he's that good.
You know, when you think about Guillermo Rigondeaux, it was the fight that all of us wanted to see Nonito Dornier. And when going back, let's take that even back further, when Nonito destroyed Fernando Montiel, that's when the praising and the bandwagons began. You know, he was fighter of the year, the pound-for-pound guy. Nobody can beat him. He's indestructible. He's got one-punch KO power. And we slowly but surely started seeing Nonito kind of shaving away his skill level, becoming a very one-dimensional guy. And what we wanted to see was him fight a high-skill level fighter to see whether or not there was some truth of him being the elite of the elite. And when it finally came down to it, we found out that Nonito Dornier is just a one-trick pony, a guy that ironically is called the Flash, who should really now just be ringside taking pictures. Now, same could be said about Rigondeaux. Pedigree of his amateur tells a lot. only having 15 or 16 fights or whatever the case is, and fought one of the guys that a lot of us were calling pound for pound best fighter of his division, of his weight class, people could be saying the same thing. But look at his record. The only one of significance is Nonito Donaire, and he's now being called a one-trick pony, and he was being called that before that. So how good is Regal? We don't know yet. Arbeco has fought the best at 122 in that tournament. He fought the guys with the who's and the who's. He's a guy that's test himself. And when you test yourself, I've always said this, when you test yourself with the best, doesn't necessarily mean you're always going to win. But it's how you test yourself and how you look after and what you do with it after. And King Kong is definitely a guy that the nickname, the name itself, he really resembles who he really is. He's a guy that's just not going to, you know, leave. He's a little guy, but, man, he's a king. And when he pounds, he's a Kong. And I think that he's going to bring out the best out of Rigondeaux. I think we're going to find out where Rigondeaux really stands, because Rigondeaux needs now to test himself with these type of fighters, these kind of guys that have been at the high level for quite some time in their career. Is Rigondeaux the old or what he used to be, the dangerous guy? I don't think so, but I think there's enough there to show us what Rigondeaux is all about. There's enough there that can hurt Rigondeaux. There's enough there that can make Rigondeaux think a little quicker and faster in the ring, and that's what we all want to see. We want to find out, is Rigondeaux the truth? Arbeco is certainly a great way to end the year to get a little closer to find out if Guillermo Rigondeaux is the truth. So I'm going to go with Guillermo Rigondeaux. I'm actually, and I told you this yesterday, I'm picking him by stopping King Kong. I think the Jackal has the power. He has the footwork. He's very deceiving in how he throws his shots. And not only that, he's got Pedro Diaz, which a lot of folks still don't want to give Pedro Diaz credit. Pedro Diaz, to me, is a mad scientist. He's what you really call a real trainer, because he brings physics, he brings math into the equations of the sciences of boxing. And those are the things that are really the base of boxing. And he does all of that. And when you do that with a gifted fighter like Rigondeaux, you're only adding more to what this guy already possesses. So I got Rigondeaux. I think he could stop Arbeco, because, for one, Arbeco tends to like to follow. Arbeco tends to be aggressive. And Arbeco tends to get a little sloppy when he decides to open up. And Arbeco is a King Kong. If you hit him, he's going to come after you. He doesn't like to let you feel like you got one up on him. And I think that's going to be the demise of his loss for Saturday night. So I got Arbeco in the later rounds. I mean, I got Rigondeaux for late round TKO.
And just to clarify, I think I'm going to go Zab Judah. I don't know if I made an actual pick there. I feel like Paulie's got the edge in some regards.
You did pick Zab.
But looking at the weigh-in pictures just now, I'm kind of just scrolling through some of the media here. I just feel more confident about Zab, because looking closer at Paulie, he looks like he did exact a toll to lose the weight.
Well, wait, dude, you can't do that, bro. You can't do that. If you make a pick, you got to stake with that pick, man. You can't, you know, jump back and forth.
I'm a reporter. I'm a reporter, not a prognosticator. The more info that happens, the more I'm able to get a clearer picture. If you look at Paulie, look how drained he looks, dude. There's the Showtime's tweeting out, you know, retweet this if you're team Paulie, or retweet this if you're team Judah. Look at the pictures. Look how look at Paulie's face, and look at Zab Judah's face. Like, just no dark circles under Zab. Like, he looks hydrated. He looks fluid. And granted, Zab's physique has fooled me in the past, but still, you know, I don't know. I like Zab. I'm just keeping my pick, but I'm not changing it by knockout or anything. But I think Zab's going to show a little something. I think he found something in the back end of that Garcia fight. And this is for King of Brooklyn.
I think you want the Zab Judah Floyd Mayweather rematch to happen. That's what's happening here, but it's okay.
I do. But at the same time, you know, I think fighters look for things to fight for. And King of Brooklyn, these are two very proud Brooklynites, two very outspoken trash talkers. And I think you look at age 30-something, 33, 34, you're looking for things to motivate you. And if it's bragging rights for the rest of your life at home in the very first Brooklyn, you know, King of Brooklyn promotion, you know there's going to be more, because they've got Brooklyn guys, they got that exclusive deal at the Barclays Center, Golden Boy. They're going to use it again like they use Knockout Kings again. To be the first one, I think both guys are really going to bring something out. But moving on over to the next fight. This fight, before we get to the real main course, Matthew Macklin versus Lamar Russ. Lamar Russ is a late replacement, but he is an undefeated guy. He's got some size in this. He's 6'2". They call him the Boxing Q out of Wilmington, North Carolina. Now, Matthew Maclin is not really coming from a good place here. I mean, to me, he still just doesn't look quite all there, you know, all back. Got stopped by Sergio Martinez.
Yeah.
He had a quick win against, you know, Joaquim Alcim. And then this year he got stopped in three rounds versus Gennady Golovkin. I mean, that's a lot of things going on, you know, a lot of violence happening on your end where you're getting stopped and you're getting beat up. And you're not allowed to get back to really be confident. Lamar Russ, you know, this was going to be a tough fight already with Willie Nelson. And they brought in a guy that's not – we don't know if he's Willie Nelson, but, you know, he's 26, and it kind of makes you think if he was going to do it, he might have done it before now. But – you know, he turned pro in 2009. He's had a solid work rate, Lamar Russ. He only fought once in 2011. That's probably where his development got screwed up. I'd be willing to bet, considering that the win was good, that it was some sort of managerial or promotional issue. But, you know, he had three fights in 2012, and he's had three in 2013. And granted, he's not fighting top-level opposition, although, you know, the two guys that he fought that were undefeated, Jonathan Cepeda and Jose Alonso, this is in 2012, he knocked them both out. So that says something. When he steps up against somebody that's undefeated, he does his job. The rest of the guys are kind of, you know, got a lot of fights, but not a lot of
more
500 fighters.
Let me ask you this.
And those are good rounds. He went eight rounds with three of them.
Right.
So that's, I'm not saying he's going to win. I like his foundation for this moment. You know,
Was he brought in as an opponent, or was he really brought in to win the fight for Saturday
That's
night?
That's the question. That's the question. Was Willie
I think he was brought in to be the sacrificial lamb. I mean, I didn't really think that they would bring him in to be the guy to be the victor. And the replacement guy is going to get the ticket of looking good on Saturday night. So I wasn't picking Maclin in the beginning, and I'm still not going to pick him just because of the way he's looked. You know, I agree with you completely. Here's a guy that hasn't looked like himself being stopped by Sergio Martinez. Gennady blew him out in three rounds. I think it's safe to say that this guy's already shop worn. It happens that quick. You know, sometimes it takes years for a guy to just kind of slowly deteriorate, but sometimes it just happens within 2 to 3 fights. And I think Maclin's just one of those guys right now. He's always fought tough, and fights like that, fighters like that, you know, they just they come and go pretty quick. You know, as soon as you know about them, it's as quick as you'll find out they're on the way out.
Unless, of course, so we're both going with Lamar Russ.
Lamar Russ, yeah. I think Lamar Russ is going to do his thing. I think that Maclin is just going to try to find his rhythm. He's going to try to find himself. I think he's walking in trying to figure out who he is, coming off of a loss with Gennady. Anybody coming off a loss with Gennady, I don't think anybody's going to rebound the way Gabriel Rosado's rebound from being beaten up by Gennady. I find it hard that Maclin's going to be able to do that, you know, just because it was a quick stoppage. He was blown out of there. The body shots were just brutal. I think Lamar Russ is just going to pick up what damage has already been done with Maclin.
And that leads us to the main event, really. I mean, I think this is the fight that we're all hoping to see. James Kirkland versus Glenn Tapia, junior middleweights. They both weighed in like a little over the limit, but that's kind of like that prospect weight, you know, we talk about, where, you know, until the fights really start becoming like for contention, for belts, you know, 12-round, like regional stuff, sometimes the prospect will weigh in around the limit that he's going to fight at, like just above it. Kirkland did it for a long time. Tapia and Kirkland did it in this fight. Kirkland's 155.1, looked very fit and ready. Glenn Tapia looked very solid at 156. He's the bigger guy. He's 5'11", and James Kirkland's 5'9". And then Kirkland's got kind of short arms. He's like 70-inch arms to 73 for Jersey Boy. Here's the difference, though. Kirkland is 27 knockouts and 31 wins, one loss to Ishida in the first round. He's been down, I believe, 5 times in his career. And the Jersey boy is 20-0 with 12 knockouts. I look at the opposition, though, and I wonder, how he matches up. I mean, against Jimmy Han, you know, he stopped him. But it was kind of a, you know, it was a chopping effort, you know. I said it before, he's Tapia is a guy that's kind of missing the gray area, really missing good inside work. And they matched him with, you know, I actually picked Han. I thought he would have more of a work rate. He just seemed very, very slow. So maybe Tapia is that fast. But then I don't know if you saw the last fight against Elko or Elso Garcia. He stopped him in 5 rounds. And dude was like 42 years old. I mean, he'd been stopped before. The fight should have been stopped. Benji Estevez was a ref. He took forever to stop this thing. I mean, it was just, you know, he did his job, Tapia. But I wasn't super impressed by that. I haven't really been super impressed by the work as a whole. And I think when this fight was signed, James Kirkland was a guy that had just signed with 50 Cent. He was thinking about training with Floyd Mayweather Sr. Instead, he went up, worked with Bob Santos for about 3 weeks. But the whole time he was getting in shape, he was working out of the Iron Jaw Gym out in Austin, Texas. And was really excited, you know, when I talked to him, probably about 2 weeks before he signed with 50 Cent, maybe three. And he just had been getting in shape. He was like 168, he said at the time. And even if he's like doing the fighter, you know, plus or minus 10 pounds when they talk about their weight, still 188 may not be that bad for how far out he was from a fight compared to most people. But I would say that he was probably telling the truth. Well, like 178, rather. He'd be saying like 168. So he gets to camp with Bob Santos. They spend 3 weeks. They do that Sean Porter sparring session I wrote about. He gets dropped. Next day, he goes back to Ann Wolf to finish out the rest of his camp, 5 weeks. I think that the Kirkland that was looking for a trainer was a guy that they wanted to fight. He might show up. He'll probably make weight, but he's going to be there to be had, and he's not going to have Ann Wolf, so that's really what makes him go. 5 weeks with Ann Wolf when he shows up, and to her, she kind of wants the fight to speak for itself, but she said this is like the most focused, like, and the best physically that I've seen him, you know, mentally focused and physically fit that he's coming to camp, maybe ever, if not in a long time. And she was basically like, I'm going to hit him with hammers and nails and whatever I can to make it so that when Glenn Tapia touches him, James won't feel a thing. He looked good. The look in his eyes is the same old James Kirkland look. His skin looked good. Like, he didn't look like he'd lost a lot of weight. And I think because he didn't have to shrink down to 54, he probably was fine. He looked similar to the way he looked before the Angulo fight. And she also said that it took 3 days for her to realize that he was back. Remember when she was on the show before and she said it took like 3 weeks and she didn't know if James right. was going to be, if there was going to be anything left. This time she said it took 3 days and she knew that he was there and they'd just been off to the races. So he's in tremendous shape. I'm going with James Kirkland. You gotta, you know, dance with the one that brung you. So I'm just going to invest one more time. I think he's one of the most exciting fighters in the world. I mean, the Molina fight is not a great example of that, but you know what? Molina's track record speaks that he's in more boring fights. Kirkland, generally chaos ensues. Give me James Kirkland in like 8 rounds in this one. Corner stoppage.
You know. Here's the thing about Johnny. I mean, Glenn Tapia. I always throw Johnny's name out there because he's one of my favorite fighters. But New Jersey boy, Glenn Tapia. I don't see a whole lot of fist pumping against James Kirkland. If you look at, and I know you've always been high on Kirkland. I have it. You know that. I'm one of the guys that just kind of wait and try to see exactly what he is. And I know you like the recklessness of him. Yeah. I like controlled. I like my guys reckless as well, but I like it controlled reckless. And the thing about James is this. I even said that, you know, he should change his name from Mandingo to the Ghost because once he comes, he's gone. I'm wondering, is he going to stick and stay around? Because when you have a fighter that's been where James has been, not just in the sport, but in life, getting locked up, he's a troublesome kid. Sometimes being self-destructive is a part of you already where it needs to happen or you just don't feel alive. You don't feel like you're functioning correctly. And that's where it really lies with James Kirkland with his whole career and his whole life. And I think it's just going to continue. But the thing is that it works for him.
Control, though, where he was at. I mean, I think this is what this fight's going to show, and I agree with what you're saying, because that's what history has shown, is that he has a tendency to, when things are good, to totally screw it up and make a bad choice.
But I think there's a point where you learn,
and I think when he went back this last time, and there's stuff that's just off the record that I can't say, the recognition, and it was like where he was trying to be in August after getting rid of the Golden Boy contract and waiting out that managerial contract. He's finally, like, where he wanted to be. And I think mentally that's a big thing, that he's in control of his career.
I hope James knows that. You have that, what we call as a parent, tough love.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I agree with you, because I've kind of been through it with him. We didn't even speak after – as tight as we've been, writer and fighter, like, you know, we don't.
He avoided
you. I wish his family well, but, like, we don't. You know, he wasn't on Fighter versus Writer. Like, I'll put it that way. But
right.
he didn't really avoid me so much as just give me the fist bump, said what's up, and, like, barely even that, and did that on entrance and exit, and that was pretty rare for us. But I think, honestly,
he avoided you. He knew you were going to ask him the real questions. He knew that you knew. More or less, you knew the most of what these other guys were trying to dig because they were kind of clueless about it. Let's be honest. You've been covering the guy from the beginning. You've had the best relationship with this guy. When he got out of prison, what show did he jump on because of what guy?
Yeah, that's true.
So it's fair to say.
It was very strange that he did it, but I think it spoke to that.
You know him better than he knows himself, Gabriel, at this point in time right now.
Well, I think only Ann would have that kind of status. I just think I could interpret what he was doing in pretty well-informed, you know, way. But I think he's just always been a guy that's a little bit suspicious, too, and I don't know if he knew what camp I was in. I tend to think he thought it was a Mike Miller guy when I always kind of have told Ann and him, like, I'm kind of about you guys. I really like your story. I care about you, too, as people. If I stopped writing about boxing, I would still care about him. But in this fight, I think it is possible for somebody to, particularly a guy hitting his 30s, he knows this is kind of the last run, and he gets that, like, the chaos that he enjoys is in the ring. And like he was saying about Anne, that she's the only woman. He was always about, like, no woman could do this or that more than me, and she's the only woman that could ever actually do more than him and take up challenges that pushed him to the limit. And he was the one that was always up for whatever challenge she had. And that's why he stood out with her. They're just made for each other. And I think he gets that. And he said as much, I think, you know, while they were in the camp. And he gets it. So I think all that they've been through, going to Mexico to beat Angulo after losing to Ishida, like, he's going to ask questions of Glenn Tapia that he knows about himself. Can you get up and finish and win in the same round? You know, like...
And here's the thing, though, for Glenn Tapia is that if any time is there to get Kirtland and what period of where he's at in his career, it's right now. But it's what he does with it. And so does Glenn Tapia have the tools to dismantle Mandingo? I don't think he does. Even a 60% Kirtland stops Glenn Tapia. I don't think Glenn Tapia is at that level. Look at his past fights. Molina gave Kirtland the most trouble when even Kirtland was not even at his 100%. But he gave him the most trouble because he closed the distance. He didn't allow Kirtland to fight in the inside. He didn't allow Kirtland to fight in the outside. He smothered him. With Glenn Tapia, his best work is to be in the outside. And guess what? That's the danger zone right there. That is the danger zone for him, because that's what Kirtland wants you to be. He'll love for you to try to mix it up with them in the inside, but if you try to stay out there on the outside perimeter where Kirtland can be a sniper, he's going to take a shot, and it's going to land, and it's going to hurt. So that's why I say I see a lot of fist pumping in from the New Jersey boy. I see a lot of mauling and a pet bull from Mandingo. I think this is a perfect fight for both of these guys, but it really just falls into who has the tools of taking advantage of the opportunity, and Kirtland obviously has those tools, especially bringing in Anna Wolf. That's the more convincing point in my mind. That is the convincing part of me saying Kirtland wins. If you would have walked in with Bob Santos, I told you this. I was like, I didn't even know Bob Santos was a trainer. I still would have been asking that. How well did he train him? How well, I mean, you know, when you get an unexperienced trainer trying to get a guy back to where he was, well, you're going to be in question in the unexperienced trainer all the time.
Well, that, and the things that Ann says to him, you know, like when you watch that Molina fight, and people sort of pointed that as a bad fight, but he dropped Molina. That's what happened at the end of the fight. He had Molina all over the place and hurt him in that last round, and there was still two rounds to go. James was slow, and he was getting hit, and he was getting pushed back, but he was still coming, and he was still throwing that lead left. It was just like I said, like he just didn't have the same energy to keep moving and be a perpetual punching machine. But he was still getting his shots in. He dropped him late. He's got mental toughness. I think you're right. He's going to have the distance. I disagree. I think the best time to get Kirkland is not when he's coming off a layoff like this and hungry. Those have actually been the most dangerous times to get him, like when he was coming for Angulo after the Ishida fight or coming out of jail. He kind of blew that heading into the Ishida fight. But I think the best time to get James Kirkland is after a big win, as Carlos Molina found, where he gets a little bit complacent.
Well,
he's got a lot built up for this fight.
I agree with you.
He's going to give us his best.
I agree with you, but history has always shown us that when you get a guy with a long layoff, not just once, twice, I mean a third time, that, you know, sometimes your luck runs out. And that's where we got to really find out. You know, obviously Al Wolf is the only one that can really – really get through to Kirkland, but sometimes that it's just not enough anymore. So that's we're going to find out if the saga continues of Kirkland or finally if the chapter has ended. But even with that said, like I said, I'm not sure if Tapia is the guy that can close that chapter, regardless if it's already almost ready to be closed. So for that, my pick is going to be Kirkland by a late TKO. I think he stops him. I think he overwhelms him. That range is going to be there where he lands, and as soon as he lands and he sees the Harlem Shuffle, Kirkland's going to be all over him, and you're going to see him stop, and then everybody's going to be happy, and we're all going to hope that 50 Cent is going to know what to do with him, because the guy that 50 was hoping to bank on and make money is Gamboa. We all know what's going on with Gamboa. So there it is. Their show right there on Leaving the Ring Radio. We'll be back on our regular scheduled day and time, which is Thursday, and no, Friday was a little awkward, you know. But, hey, we figured just do it Friday
awkward.
Rather not do a show. Yeah, you know, rather than do it at all. And
I'm thinking also,
what can I
say? One more fight. At the Porsche Arena in Stuttgart, Germany, Sky Sports, Darren Barker, Felix Sturm, middleweight, 12 rounds, Sturm's IBF title. This is a good fight, man. I kind of tend to think that what Sturm's got left might be enough to keep Darren Barker off. Barker's going to have to be active. He's going to have to let it go, or he's going to get dominated by the jab. You know, Felix Sturm has dropped some decisions in Germany. He's starting to slow down. I tend to favor Barker in this and kind of wearing Sturm down and maybe even putting him down late.
Sturm is one of those old dogs, man, that just don't want to let go of that bone. That's what I like about Sturm. but he's been saved, though. Let's be honest. You know, he's been saved by Germany. And he is slowing down. This guy's been in a lot of fights. I mean, we don't give credit where credit sometimes is due, where Sturm was fighting the who's and the what's and his division. But he's been played safe by staying home. Barker's a guy, though, that he's strong, he's durable, and he can match you for whatever you're going to do, especially what Stern's able to offer right now. So, you know what? I know you're going to go with Barker. I'm going to go with Sturm, man. I think the old man still got it. I don't think he's going to let go of that bone. I think he's going to do enough. I mean, if he still has that jab and he still has those fundamentals right there. He still knows how to put combinations. He's never been a flashy guy, and sometimes not being a flashy guy from the beginning, it always gives you a lot more longevity in your career. So I'm going to go with Sturm. Decision.
All right. And there it is.
There you go.
The weekend
there's your show.
Schedule.
Everybody have a great weekend. Enjoy your Friday, Saturday night fights. You know, enjoy being with your family. We'll see you guys next week, Thursday night, on Leaving the Ring at the same schedule and time. Don't forget Monday night, the next round. And don't forget also Tijuana Boxeo Radio on our website. Again, have a great weekend. Don't drink and drive, because you know what will happen. You will spill your beer.
Peace.
Hey, bro. Next weekend, brother.
I'll see you later. Enjoy the fights.
Peace.